Again, more on history, and this time a little bit more on Sufi influence. I did mention it last time. But I also want to just begin with a little bit of a story from one of my students. You know, quite a few of our students take these classes, and then they go out and they work, you know, and they send back some interesting stuff. I find it very interesting, and I pray for them, so I'm hoping that you too will do the same, send back any stories on folk practices to your old professor. It would be much appreciated. But one of my students wrote back something that I found very interesting, and he talked, and she talked about use of the word mashallah. In other words, remember we used a couple lectures ago, you know, God be praised or God be thanked, something like that. And these students were out there in one of these places, I think in South Asia somewhere, and they came back home one day from being away for a little while, and their landlord had painted the house. He'd painted it a purple, and so they objected, or at least the painting was going on. They said, you know, we really want that house that we're renting from you to be white rather than purple. So they were able to get it done in white. But then the landlord, they say, these students of ours who had taken some Islam, they said that the landlord consented to get it white, but he had the last word on the foundation. Now listen carefully. The color was not the only surprise. The painter had written Mashallah across one of the foundation stones. When we saw it, we knew we could never paint over it. So because they said, you know, such an act would be a great insult. Mashallah, loosely translated, means God allows it. Such a statement is often found on new houses. It serves several purposes. First of all, it acknowledges God as the source of blessings, and rightly so, but by so doing, such a phrase causes us to remember God as the giver of good gifts. At the same time, mashallah can deflect a judgmental attitude in a guest. If I were to question the appropriateness of something extravagant in my neighborhood's possession, the fact that God allowed him to have such a thing, like a satellite dish or a luxury car or even a beautiful house, should soften any criticism and envy. It is the guard against envy that may be the greatest motivation for these words on your house. A felt need here amongst the number of people is the need to ward off the evil eye. Mashallah can do just that. It can protect the possessors of a new house like ours from a potential disaster and from a curse. So they'll do it even for foreigners or missionaries or whoever they are. I've seen this myself. One neighbor where I was in Pakistan built a beautiful house, and it was much higher than houses in the immediate area. What did he do? He wrote mashallah really up high so that it would ward off any envy or jealousy. Now, we're going to talk now about Sufi influences, and there's a chart here, and I wanted to point out something about this chart. The main thing in this chart is that Sufi influence goes both ways. Just like fundamentalism goes both ways, into Sunnis and Shiites and everyone else, it goes into both branches of Islam. Now, in Islam, you have two major divisions. You have the Sunnis, of course, which are the... they have the lion's share of Muslims. 85% of the Muslims in the world are Sunnis. You have Sunnis here, and they have their four schools of law, Hanafis, Malikis, Shafis, and Hanbalis. And we had Hanafis in South Asia, specifically Pakistan, but India as well. You have different schools of law in different parts of the Muslim world. The Muslim world is vast, and so They have four schools of law. In other words, there are some differences on what they've decided, like, you know, the punishment that should be given to for this and that and the other thing. But notice that there's a broken line here, Ahmadiyyas. That's broken because they're a heretical sect. And you have about 4 million of them in Pakistan. They're persecuted more than the Christians are. The reason they're persecuted is because they say, well, you know, you're not really Muslims. You call yourself a Muslim because they had a prophet who came after Muhammad, and that's a terrible blasphemy. From the schools of law, you have the Muslim Brotherhood and other Islamic associations that come out of that, like the Hamas, not the Hezbollah. They would be come out of this the Shiites. But on this side, of course, you have the Shiites, different brands of Shiites, the Imamites, the Ismailis, the Zaydis, better known as the Twelvers, the Seveners, and the Fivers. And then you have heretical sects there too, such as the Alawites in Syria, believe it or not. They are really, heretical. So I think the point here of the whole discussion here is that Islam was spread through Sufi saints primarily. Now, we were talking in the last slide about this Sufi spreading all over the place. In other words, Sufism actually has permeated both sides of Islam. But you know, it's quite interesting to think of the fact that Islam has not spread primarily across the hundreds and hundreds of years through force, through the sword, but rather through Sufi influence. This is true in Persia, or which is now Iran, and Western Asia. It's true in Central Asia, India, Indonesia, and Africa. I wanted to tell you a little bit of a story here about Data Ganj Baksh. When my editor wrote this, she, after data, she had a colon as if it was data, but it's not data. It's an Urdu word, and it refers to a saint in Pakistan, in Lahore, in that beautiful Mughal city of Lahore. It's right next to a mosque that's the glory of the Punjab for its beauty. It's the called the Badshahi Mosque. Badshah means king. So right next to that mosque is a shrine. And it's Data Ganj Baksh is the sort of the name is given to that Sufi saint. And the reason why he is so popular is because the Muslims say that he spread Islam in that area. Just by healing and praying for people and associating with them. One of my friends went there on a regular basis when he was doing his MA in English. He helped to teach my wife, me and my wife, Urdu, not English, but Urdu in Pakistan. And he was very good in English. And he'd done his MA in English. And he was telling me that the reason he passed his MA exams, obviously very stiff, was that that Sufi saint helped him, Data Ganj Baksh, because he would go there every week when he was doing this MA. And the saint helped him. So you see, what you have then is we're still talking history, and the animistic beliefs and symbols were there ahead of time, and again, it's a bit repetitious, but low Islam has basically adapted beliefs and principles, symbols. High Islam has interpreted the symbols, like the Hajj. By that I mean that and we mentioned this in the last lecture, that the pilgrimage was there before Muhammad, and he took it, and he whitewashed it, and he brought some things into, in fact, he brought a lot of it into Islam, so that you have today the pilgrimage is one of the five pillars of Islam. I have a question here. It's really one of the forum questions. Are there any Islamic symbols being reinterpreted today? For example, how do veiled women want to be perceived? Is it working? So you can discuss that in the forum. So I won't go into detail here, but what about other symbols? Are there Islamic symbols being reinterpreted today? Obviously, the burqas and beards and burqas are. Beards meaning that, when we see beards, we generally think Taliban. But Muslims are trying to get across to us that beards don't necessarily mean extremism. And I think they're right, except that if you walk through an airport with a beard today in the Western world, you're probably going to get pulled over. And so the Muslims are trying to reinterpret that, and certainly, but there are other symbols too. If you were to Google Islamic symbols, things would might come up like the crescent moon. When some people in the West see the crescent moon, I think they mistakenly think that signifies a moon god. And that's where it came from. I don't think that's true, but they are. That's the impression that they give. So there are quite a few Islamic symbols, and you can maybe think of more that are with us. And Muslims sometimes are trying to reinterpret them. And on the other hand, sometimes we take their symbols and try to reinterpret them ourselves. For instance, if you see a Muslim in, a Muslim in the West with his dress on, if he walks into a church, probably people are going to take that symbol and they're going to think extremism, which is not necessarily true. This is just a picture of a shrine and there are shrines all over the place, all over the Muslim world. But this is really what I wanted to talk about in the end, and to show the relationship between Orthodox Islam. I have a question there because, we can't be too dogmatic in saying what Orthodox Islam is. But we can also see from this chart that there is a type of Sufism that is higher, more noble, if we can say that, than what is generally practiced in folk or popular Islam. What do we mean by that? Well, we mean by that in Sufism there is evidence of some nobility and love of God that you don't always see down here in folk or popular Islam, where there are quite a few charlatans, quite a few people in it for the money, writing blessings out of the Quran and selling them, and something like was going on in the Roman Catholic Church at the time of Martin Luther, corruptions that he reacted against and others did as well. But what I'm trying to say is that there were periods in the history of Islam when Sufism was more prominent, and Also, we can say that in some cases there is degeneration or deterioration today, and a lot of stuff goes on in popular Islam that is not the best. But there is an overlap, as I suggested before, and so let's keep that in mind. I wanted also to share something with the Bible, from the Bible, that I was just thinking about this morning, as to why Muslims get into this. And I was thinking of Psalm 90, and you will know the psalm. It's the psalm of Moses. And Moses there in that psalm, I think the only one that he wrote, he talks about the things that really worry people. as far as I can see. I was reading this morning, and I was struck by some of the things he says. He says, for example, he says that, you know, our lives are so short. He says that our days pass away under your wrath. We finish our years with a moan. The length of our days are 70 years or 80, if we have the strength. Yet the span is but trouble and sorrow. So Moses talks about the brevity of life. And I think he also talks about the fact that our sins are quite obvious. He says, in verse 8, you've set our iniquities before you, our secret sins in the light of your presence. So our days are short, our sins are obvious, and I think you could go on to say that not only are our days short, but in many ways they are, life is a bit of a routine, and it is often boring. And so then he goes on to say at the end of this Psalm 90, he says, satisfy, verse 14, satisfy us in the morning with your unfailing love, that we may sing for joy and be glad all our days. Make us glad for as many days as you've afflicted us, for as many years as you've seen trouble. So you know what? We need God. We need his presence. We need a personal relationship with him. And we struggle with this as human beings. Muslims do too. They struggle with all kinds of things. So they get into counterfeits because of their loneliness, because of their boredom, because of the brevity of their life, often more brief than ours. And so they get into folk practices because of their need for God. You know, when we see these things, it should give us a greater burden for them, not a condemnation, even when we see extremism. A sorrow for them, a grief for them, a burden for them, because really they need the Lord just like we do. I remember a song we used to sing, haven't heard it for many, many years, people need the Lord. So that's really what we think of in reference to Muslims.